Hello, once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Friday, March 1st edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and 5 hour and 10 minutes or so. As we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me as we wrap up this week here on Bang the Book Radio, doing the full show on Skype because Blog Talk Radio up to its shenanigans here on this Friday. But two good segments coming your way here today. The first, a UFC 235 preview with Christian Pina of the Gambling Podcast, and also our bangthebook.com UFC contributor, John Jones, Anthony Smith, the main event, Tyron Woodley, Kamaru Usman in the lead up to the main event. Both of those title fights, we talked about those. Also the rest of the UFC 235 card out in Las Vegas. Second half of today's show, Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. For our second handicapping the hardwood segment here for this week, we'll chat about the MEAC. We'll talk about the Atlantic Sun Conference tournament. We'll tell you why during the segment. We'll also talk about some games here for this weekend, including the rematch between Kentucky and Tennessee. So a really good college basketball segment coming your way here today. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. You know about the daily stuff from Kyle Hunter and Parker Michaels. Daily NBA, college basketball, NHL updates over there. Also golf, tennis, UFC, soccer, all kinds of great stuff going on at bangthebook.com. Make sure you check it out. And also next week, I'll be releasing my Major League Baseball stuff, my 30 MLB season win total previews, futures odds for AL, NL, and World Series, home run king, Cy Young, MVP, all that stuff going to be posted over at bangthebook.com. We're also doing it this year as a Kindle ebook, and there will be a PDF at bangthebook.com as well. So lots of ways to get my betting guide. And as we go throughout the month of March here, I'm going to do a follow-up guide, probably 30 to 35 pages with betting tips for each individual team, looking at some pitchers, some team angles, stuff like that. So you can look forward to that here in the month of March as well. As you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB200 is that promo code, 100% deposit match bonus up to $500, 100% deposit match bonus up to $500 for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. So we start things off with the UFC 235 preview that I recorded yesterday with Christian Pina. In fact, can be dated because we recorded that yesterday. And even in the intro, mentioned hoping Bryce Harper signs somewhere. So it'll give you an idea of when we recorded that. In any event, great UFC breakdown there with Christian for UFC 235. And here is that segment with him. All right, I'm joined now by Christian Pina of the Gambling Podcast. He's also our UFC contributor at bangthebook.com. We got two title fights here this weekend for UFC 235 in Las Vegas. Christian, how's it going today, man?
Good, man. Finally, a weather update as I do every week here. It is gorgeous, 70s and sunny in Vegas. I know you're finally getting over a little bit of sickness here, so I think we're finally out of the gambling winter and the real-life winter apocalypse that we're at here, huh?
It's still cold here. I was looking at the March forecast, and we're not going to warm up until the middle of the month, so I don't know. Maybe I just need to come out there and enjoy the 70-degree weather. By the way, with you being out in Las Vegas, can you do me a huge favor? Go track down Bryce Harper. Tell him to sign with somebody so I can finish my damn baseball writing.
It's funny. MVP odds and Cy Young odds came up out here in Vegas yesterday, and Bryce Harper is the NL MVP favorite without a team right now.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. In fact, I saw that some division futures are off the board now at some of the offshore places because everyone's waiting to see where he's going to wind up going. Hopefully that happens here in the very near future. And who knows, maybe it'll happen by the time everybody hears this segment on our Friday edition of Bang the Book Radio, as we are recording Thursday afternoon here. So some of these odds most definitely may have moved by that point in time. So keep that in mind as you're breaking down the card. But let's start with the main event for UFC 235 here. Title fight in the light heavyweight division. Anthony Smith is talking a lot in the lead up to this fight, Christian. Does he have a chance to pull the upset?
He has a more of a chance than the odds would indicate. And truthfully, a little bit of money. Again, this UFC is a little bit different, and the public loves to bet a little to win a lot. So his price has actually kind of come down a little bit. John Jones was in the neighborhood of minus 950. Currently sits about minus 895 as I look in town. Look, the heart of a fighter is something that cannot be understated, especially in a sport with such variance as mixed martial arts. Truthfully, when you kind of look at this from a blanket perspective, John Jones is better everywhere. And then the odds kind of tell the story of that. And you know, in a perfect world, Smith would kind of utilize the OSP type of game plan, which would be to blitz straight up the middle, get in close, and not allow John Jones to utilize that, you know, freakish reach that he is famous for, not allowed to use that lateral movement and stick and move type ability, you know, type of game that he's, you know, made famous at this point. You know, people have doubted Anthony Smith his whole career, and all the guy does is win and win as an underdog. And like I said, there's something certainly to be said for this. But when you really break this down, I mean, John Jones is looking to make up for lost time, in my opinion, by, you know, taking these fights and doing all these type of situations. So this one, there's not a ton to say about it to me. There's certainly a fighter's chance, a puncher's chance, and Anthony Smith certainly has that. But all things being equal, this is John Jones' fight, and it's more of a when and not an if type of situation. Again, crazy variants and of the sport aside, pure type of odds, you know, probabilities. This is John Jones' fight going away here.
All right, so let's move on to the welterweight championship fight. There's a lot more to talk about with this one. As you wrote in your preview over at bangthebook.com, I highly recommend that for everybody listening to this segment here. Tyron Woodley in the minus 150 range. Kamaru Usman is the underdog plus 120. Now, you and I were talking before we started recording here. There are a lot of intriguing things about this matchup.
Yeah, this is, to me, you know, a guy like Tyron Woodley, to me, is, I know a lot of casual UFC fans hate the guy, and they hate him for a variety of reasons. They hate him the same way that boxing fans, quote unquote, hate Floyd Mayweather, because every fight is virtually by decision. You know, as the theme of, you know, doing these previews with you, the one overlapping thing is I value fight IQ more than anything else, and nobody has more fight IQ than Tyron Woodley. He is a, I don't want to say perfect, but he is getting close to the perfect mixed martial artist from a mental perspective. He knows no matter the opponent, he knows exactly what to do, and he doesn't care whether people like it. Again, he's about cashing checks, winning championships. And to me, that type of fighter, again, much like a Floyd Mayweather, has proven to be a cash cow. You know, it's something, it's a little bit reversed here, but it's something like betting an under in football or baseball, and it's nothing going into the fourth quarter or the ninth inning. You know, it's boring, but when you're on the over in these type of situations, you absolutely love it, whether it be Floyd Mayweather by decision or Tyron Woodley by decision or the over in these type of situations. And so, to me, again, Woodley is on another level, time and time again, both in the round props and being able to bet on him has been a treat, while people, you know, still kind of get on him for that, for the inactivity, while he just kind of does what he needs to do to retain his championship in advance. And on the other side, this is why this is such a compelling matchup here, because a guy like Usman, who's pretty much been the most ducked fighter in the UFC for going on 6 months now, nobody wants a piece of him. And the reason this fight, and again, Usman's taken some serious money over the past day or two. I believe he's up around plus 180, plus 150, all the way down to the plus 120 as I look at the market right now. Usman has, you know, there's a little bit of a Dillashaw Garbrandt feel to this fight, in that Usman may just do what Woodley does, but do it better, be more aggressive, where Woodley, you know, is what I would call methodical and patient. Some would call boring. Usman, while he doesn't necessarily, you know, finish a ton of fights, he's dominating decisions, because what he's doing within those, you know, in those rounds is so much more active than anyone else, smothering people, striking. And if Woodley, you know, is able, you know, if he wants to kind of do what he's always done and be able to take that slow approach, feel each other out, if Usman kind of comes out on fire and just does that game plan better, there could be an upset here. But again, you can lose many times betting against a streak and only lose once betting on it. So for that, until I see Woodley, you know, take that loss, I have to go with my guy that's been so good for me over his career, and that's Woodley. But this is a very tough matchup. I would say the toughest for Woodley since Wonderboy, even, you know, even more than a guy like Darren Till, who, again, bet against Till in that situation, felt it was too much too soon. And, you know, truth be told, bet against Till on Wonderboy, and that, you know, the fight before that, because I thought it was too much too soon. So It's a very intriguing matchup for a variety of reasons, and casual fans may not like it, but the MMA purists are going to absolutely love this chess match of a back and forth fight.
Now, obviously this could be dated by the time that listeners hear this on Friday, but do you think that this is the stopping point for this line? I mean, where do you sort of expect this thing to go as we get closer to the fight?
Again, yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell with this, because a guy like Woodley does not generate a ton of public support at the betting window, because frankly, people want to see him lose. He's not an exciting fighter. He's, you know, the Delphi version of a point fighter, if you will. So it's a little bit weird, because I think the value is certainly gone from a guy like Usman. When you look at this across the board, you know, when you look at past to victory for Usman, you know, maybe his striking has definitely gotten better, but it's not on the caliber of Woodley. And people forget, you know, Woodley has really evolved his game into this type of fighter when he was more one-dimensional. He's really kind of been all, you know, come full circle a little bit here. So you'd think, all right, Usman has been so dominant in the takedown department. Well, then you look over at the other side of the board and Woodley has a 94% takedown defense. So I get people taking the shot in the, you know, upwards of plus 150 range. I think the line is probably, you know, the value, quote unquote, is gone at this point, but I don't know if that's going to stop the public from, you know, looking to bet against a quote unquote boring fighter in Woodley. And, you know, the quote unquote Nigerian nightmare at plus money makes sense. So I wouldn't recommend it now that the value is gone, but I could certainly see it getting down into the, you know, minus 130 even money type of range at most, but this is probably where it stays.
Another really intriguing fight here between Robbie Lawler and Ben Askren. This is the UFC debut for Ben Askren, and he's out here against a well-known commodity in Robbie Lawler as a minus 275 favorite over at DSI Sportsbook. This is another fight that you and I were talking about a little bit before we started recording here, that there are a lot of layers to this one too.
Certainly are. And for anyone that doesn't know Ben Askren, the UFC effectively made the first mixed martial arts trade in history to get him on the roster, trading Demetrius Johnson out to his organization, receiving, you know, his contract and receiving Ben Askren back. Ben Askren is, he has been unbelievable. He may, for anyone that's a fan of Khabib Nurmagomedov, this guy, Ben Askren, may have better chain wrestling than Khabib. And it's really something that sounds crazy to say, but I've never seen chain wrestling on this level. Now, on the feet, he has nothing. Let's just say that. You know, when people always talk about, myself included, the quote-unquote striker versus grappler and all those cliches, this is the fight where all those, you know, start from, all those terms. This is the purest striker versus grappler matchup I have probably ever seen inside the UFC. Robbie Lawler, you know, so famous for, you know, coming back from the dead and these blitzes and these seemingly impossible knockout victories, submissions, everything and everything along the way. Lawler has the advantage in this fight as long as it stays on the feet. The thing about this is Lawler's coming off a torn ACL. We don't know the status of that injury. We don't know, you know, kind of where he's at there. And he has been, you know, he's fought wrestlers in the past and done very well in the takedown defense department and all that type of stuff. So it's very, you know, I hate to sound cliche and say that this is a classic striker versus grappler matchup, but this is the classic striker versus grappler. Askren is going to go for takedowns morning, noon, and night from the second the bell rings until the second the bell goes down. And if he is able to land just one, again, if Lawler stops 95% of them and he is able to get one, Lawler's not going to be able to get back up. That is how good Ben Askren is. If you have seen, you know, early Khabib fights against, you know, bottom of the barrel type of opponents where he was able to just smother them, and even Daniel Cormier to an extent in some situations, you know, the Anderson Silva fight comes to mind where people hated that, where he just laid on top of him. That's the type of ability Ben Askren has to make, you know, a fighter the caliber of Robbie Lawler look that badly. It's really incredible. If anyone hasn't seen, you know, kind of his stuff in Bellator and the different type of, you know, organizations he's been in, look it up and you're going to be amazed. And it's a weird fight because stylistically it's not great for a guy like Askren. In theory, you would think that after effectively sending out, you know, the greatest of all time to get Askren in return, I mean, this is how highly touted this kid is, and they did not want to leave him, you know, let him go out of different organizations. Held championships every single where that he's gone. And this is just a little bit, you would think the UFC wants to get him a win here. I understand putting him up against a, you know, caliber of opponent like this. It's just, if he is not able to land these takedowns, that minus 280 is going to be very bad. But again, people have said that about Khabib. Would he be able to land those takedowns on, you know, anyone that he's fought along the way, including McGregor? He's always been able to eventually do it, and to the tune of an undefeated record. And that most likely is the case for a guy like Askren here. It's just, the price is, you know, really betting on that type of situation. So it's a little bit of a hyped up line. And for that situation, you know, I can't really, you know, with that much unknowns, I can't let somebody lay, you know, minus 280 straight bet or something like that. But the over certainly makes some sense. If Askren is going to do this, I would think it would be a decision unless it's a stoppage along the way or Lawler's knee gives out or that type of situation. So look for a different couple of angles in that situation in this fight.
Now, you and I have been talking a little bit of baseball here today off the air, and I want to sort of bring a baseball theme to this fight, with Lawler being 36 now, coming off of the ACL. Got to figure, I don't know what the UFC aging curve looks like necessarily. It's not something I've ever really looked into, but how much does his age matter to you coming off of the big injury here?
Yeah, I mean, it's really more of the injury to me than the age. I mean, we see, you know, quote unquote, older guys, you know, in the UFC do well, and we see them do bad. There's not really a blueprint to say, oh, once, you know, in the NFL, you see running backs fall off a cliff at age 30, right? And that's not really the case here, because in truth, you know, fight years are really what matters. And again, Robbie Lawler, certainly every bit of old of his, in fight years as his actual age is. I mean, the guy has been through every single war out there. And in truth, when you look at this from a non, you know, quote unquote, X's and O's standpoint, the UFC wants to get Askren this win off a notable opponent. And Lawler certainly does this. I would be more concerned about the injury than I would the age, if that makes sense. It's just, it is one more red flag. Would you like him to be younger? Of course. But the age doesn't matter so much as the punishment and the abuse he's gone. And again, MMA years in cage time certainly counts a lot more than, you know, quote unquote, actual age for me.
Now, I believe we had four women's fights on last week's card, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago. We've got three of them here on this card. Strawweight division matchup between Torres and Zhang. This one, almost essentially a coin flip. Zhang, a little bit of a favorite here.
Yeah, and this one, I mean, again, I was somebody who got in on the Tisha Torres train at about plus 120. This has come down a little bit here. It makes some sense. And again, that's not to say that I think that Torres is definitely the preferred side. It's just that was a little bit of a bad line, in my opinion. And I think a lot of people felt that way. And that's why you've seen some movement coming on the Torres side here. This one is, like you said, coin flip. It's different. Fighters going in different directions here. You know, Tisha Torres being called the tiny tornado. It's really not the case here with her at this point in her career. She's kind of given up aggressiveness and the fury for patience. And she's more of a, you know, kickboxer. She's not, doesn't have the same, you know, at this stage of her career, doesn't have the same tools that she once had, doesn't have the same speed. And when you look at the other side and a girl like Zhang, it may be fair to say that she does everything Torres does better. She's an elite kickboxer, a professional kickboxer, and the rest of her MMA is certainly coming around. And if Zhang is able to get this, you know, quote unquote, top five win here, she is a flashy fighter that the UFC can market as a finisher when in a division that does not have any. That being said, this is a Tisha Torres fight, so it's about 98% probable that it's going to go to decision. So I think that over makes some sense in a parlay. But Zhang is going to get a rocket strapped to her back if she is able to get this notable name victory. And again, Torres coming off two losses, wants to get back in the win column. This is a very tough matchup and one that I would think back against the wall for Torres, while Zhang has everything to gain, as well as would probably be vaulted into a title eliminator after this fight if she was able to win that, right into the title picture there as well. So ton on the line here. I would say more so for Zhang, but Torres needs to get back on track after two losses. And again, Torres is the type of girl with the type of pedigree that will a third loss get her cut from the organization? No, she's still going to be a staple. She's still going to, you know, do her thing and go to the decision and put on a classic women's fight. So Zhang certainly has more to gain, but Torres, you know, needs to get back on track here if she ever wants to get back in that discussion. I just don't think it would. It's, you know, this is just a little bit of a bad matchup for someone that just does things a little bit better at this stage with a girl like Zhang. So definitely would side towards Zhang in the minus 120 range.
The first three fights here for this card on UFC Fight Pass, the next four on ESPN. The first of the pay-per-view fights, and there are five of them, Cody Garbrandt takes on Pedro Munhoz. Garbrandt minus 140 favorite here in this one. I know you've got some thoughts on this fight as well.
Yeah, Garbrandt here. I mean, this is the mental aspect of UFC that we always talk about, because for the first time in his life, after starting 11-0 and lighting the world on fire in the mixed martial arts community, Garbrandt is, you know, back against the wall, losing two straight. Granted, it was against the same opponent, so it's a little bit, it's looked at a little bit differently. I think in some ways, much like we talked about, at the top of the show, it's just a fighter that does something a little bit better, uses like the Usman and Woodley fight. Dillashaw used Garbrandt's game plan and just did a better job of it. So I don't look at it as, you know, a two fight losing streak, although, you know, that's what the scoreboard's going to say. He lost to the same guy twice and a guy just has his number. And I think that there's something to be said for that, but when you look at this, Garbrandt doesn't need to go back to the drawing board, in my opinion here. He just, again, he needs to kind of put that Dillashaw saga out of his mind and go back to what he does. He just ran up to a guy that has his number. And if he's able to do that, again, you know, doing this blanketly across the board. He's the more well-rounded mixed martial artist, no doubt about it, against a guy like Munoz. Munoz, certainly dangerous, the best guillotine in the division that he can hit from absolutely anywhere. Always dangerous. Garbrandt needs to get back to, you know, what he did pre-Dillashaw, which is use the distance, use the point fighting, use his, you know, All-American wrestling. Use everything that he kind of, before he fell in love with that unbelievable, you know, right hand of his and all that type of stuff, the flash. You know, this is something of a, there's a cautionary tale in here amongst many fighters, you know, of where Garbrandt could go here, you know, whether it be the route of Lando Venata or, you know, falling in love with flash is a very, very dangerous thing. When you just get down to basics, Garbrandt is, you know, a top two to top three in the division. And if he executes his game plan, doesn't let the, you know, last two fights creep into his head. I actually think you're getting a little bit of a discount on a guy like Garbrandt. Again, not to take anything away from Munoz. I just think that when you look at it across the board, Garbrandt, the far and away more well-rounded fight. But if Dillashaw is still in his mind, and again, the weird thing about this fight is there's not really, you know, Garbrandt can't fight Dillashaw again. They're not going to make that fight again. It's very clear what happens when those two fight. So he has to wait for Dillashaw to drop the belt or lose a fight to kind of go up again. And so if any of those things are kind of in the back of his mind, that could certainly spell trouble for him. But I think that that is actually a little bit built into the line and where that discount comes from here.
All right. So as we look at the rest of the card here, seven other matchups, again, five on the main card, which is on pay-per-view. What do you think about the prelims? Anything stand out to you there?
Yeah, I think you know, a name that casual fans will recognize, Jeremy Stevens in the plus 200 range against Zabit Magomed Sharipov. And I mean, Zabit has been the whitest, hottest prospect to come into the UFC in a very long time. And, you know, putting on wars for the casual fan with Kyle Bochniak and submissions. And he's done everything. He has passed every test with flying colors. And so I understand this line being a little bit wide as it is. And there's a little bit of a, you know, misguided notion on Jeremy Stevens. People think he is this brilliant knockout artist. And he is. I mean, again, crazy knockout numbers throughout his career. But if you look back, I mean, one knockout in his last 10 fights. And at this point, he's good for a knockout about every 2 years. I know he's had the back-to-back ones of Choi and Emmett. I understand that. But I look at that as, you know, I don't think, you know, Stevens is quote unquote back. I think that that was just the quality of opponent in Emmett and Choi. And so it's been really, I don't want to say interesting, but I think the pendulum has just swung so far in the direction of Stevens is this brilliant knockout artist where, you know, I understand he has 19 career knockouts, but those were very early on in his career. And we're talking about a guy in Stevens who has the resume that rivals, you know, Donald Cerrone in terms of activeness and knockouts and all that type of stuff. Look, Zabit is, you know, he has passed every test. They're trying to work him towards a title opportunity. That's what this fight is. It's a brand name that UFC casual fans will know. So when they see him, they understand who he is and who he is beaten. Zabit needs to respect that power. As again, I know I kind of sound back and forth on, is Stevens a knockout artist? Is he not? I just think that if you're able to plan for it, you can kind of work around it. And that's what Zabit is built to do. He is long. He is lanky. He can use his wrestling, keep Stevens on the ground. This fight in a perfect world for Zabit is a takedown, lays on him for 3 minutes. They stand them up, or 5 minutes, they stand him up, and he does it two more times, and he wins a 30-27. If he wants to stand and bang with him, look, Zabit proved that he can stand and bang with Kyle Bochniak in a war that UFC fans will remember very fondly for a very long time. Bochniak does not have the finishing power of Jeremy Stevens, that is for sure. And if that was Stevens in that firefight, I don't know that Zabit would have been able to stand that, but I do think that Zabit has the fight IQ and has the coaching staff behind him to know that, plan for it, and keep this fight on the ground and win a very comfortable decision.
All right, so anything else on the prelim card that you're looking at here? I know you mentioned Diego Sanchez is a pretty interesting fight against Mickey Gall.
Yeah, and Mickey Gall is a guy that, quite frankly, I don't think is, say, very good, because I have the utmost respect for anyone who steps into a UFC octagon, but I think he's been he's been fortunate to have the quality of opponents and stages at their career that he's had, and I'm not sure why. I understand it with a guy like Sage Northcutt, certainly. Look, Mickey Gall is, like we talked about with Manny Bermudez, and again, I know Bermudez won that fight using his one trick. Mickey Gall is a one trick pony. He uses the rear naked choke like it's his WWE finisher. He has won, you know, every fight, five fights, by rear naked choke. The only problem with that is while Diego Sanchez is quote unquote washed up, quote unquote chinny, quote unquote whatever you want to call him at this stage of his career, never been submitted. And when you have a one-dimensional fighter who's going up against the, you know, a veteran like that whose strength is their one dimension, this is kind of, you know, two rocks being banged up against each other here. Diego Sanchez is not what he used to be. I completely understand that. But for Mickey Gall at minus 225, you're betting on him getting a rear naked choke on a guy who's never been submitted. That's just not something long-term I would get into the business of doing. And again, Diego Sanchez coming in for as a very similar priced underdog in his last fight via decision. Personally, I just think that the veteran savvy, if you will, of Sanchez should be able, you know, Mickey Gall does one thing very good. He's good at getting takedowns and taking the back, as you've seen. And if he's able to do that against Sanchez, I think you tip your cap and move on. But to me, the plus 205 or even the over makes some sense here. And again, this is very cut and dry. If Gall is going to win, I don't see Gall being able to win a decision. I think this is a rear naked choke. It's a submission along the way. And until Sanchez proves that he's able to be submitted, I can't lay minus 225 or anything close to it there. So the underdog makes some sense at plus 205.
Any other barking dogs on the prelim card?
Yeah, smaller dog here in the plus 120, plus 130 range here. Johnny Walker, Misha Sirkinov. Johnny Walker, again, I feel like we talk about this guy every single time because all he does is fight in 2019, and he is on a meteoric rise as a prospect. He's stepping in on short notice for Ovince St. Preux, with about just a month removed from his last fight. And look, Johnny Walker has looked good. I really do worry about this timetable for him. You know, there's certain situations in the UFC where a fighter can, you know, quote unquote, smell themselves or kind of be, you know, kind of buy into their own hype. And I think that Johnny Walker feels a little bit like he's invincible right now. And now look, as he should, he has come in and set the UFC on fire. And there's can't take anything away from the kid for that. You look at a guy like Sirkinov, though. He had the same pedigree when he came into the UFC. And so look, there's, you know, Walker, there's a chance, and not in a good way, that he, you know, gets a little too much Uriah Hall or Lando Venata into his game if he relies on the, you know, the variants of his flashy finishes. And those are not always going to be there. I need to see him kind of bite down when nothing else works and, you know, make that fight, you know, win a fight he probably should have lost. And at the price of minus 150, I think this should be much closer to a pick'em. Sirkinov finished 8 of his last 12 via submission. I think this is just not a great matchup for Walker, especially on short notice. I think that he wants to kind of get in there, stand and bang. And I think Sirkinov is just, you know, crafty might be the word, to work a submission in there. So the plus 120 range of Misha Sirkinov certainly makes some sense as well.
Christian Pino, who's working, you can check out on the Gambling Podcast. You can read his UFC 235 preview over at bangthebook.com and also follow him on Twitter at Christian Pina, P-I-N-A. Always appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much for breaking this down with us. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, buddy. Good luck this weekend.
All right, good breakdown there of the UFC 235 card. Again, a couple of title fights on it and some fights that Christian really likes on the rest of the main card as well as the preliminary card. Go read his preview over at bangthebook.com. Fantastic piece of work there from Christian. We're very lucky and very happy to have him at bangthebook.com. We got one more guest and one more segment for this week on Bang the Book Radio is Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com for our second Handicapping the Hardwood segment. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
It's going well, man. How about yourself?
Doing very well, buddy. Appreciate the time as always here, sir. And we're going to start things off with the last conference that we have to cover. That is the MEAC, and this conference is terrible.
Yeah, this is a weak conference. I knew it was a weak conference. I started looking at it even more. It's weaker than I thought. Very weak conference. This is a conference where most teams don't shoot it very well. You get a lot of free throw attempts, a bunch of offensive rebounds, second chance points here. You know, to me, this is a conference where most of the teams are bunched pretty close together. None of them really that great. I think Norfolk State's clearly the best team in this league. If you look at Norfolk State, what really stands out to you about them is they're a MEAC team that can really shoot it. 41.3% from three in conference play, pretty easily first in the conference when it comes to shooting percentages. So, you know, if you can shoot it and you can take care of the ball, which is also kind of rare in this conference, then that's going to be something that's going to give you an edge. To me, you know, this is a conference where it's kind of hard to predict how things will go in a conference tournament because Norfolk State, the best team here, but there's a lot of teams here that could end up in the final and it wouldn't be very surprising. It's just, you know, whoever comes out of this conference is going to have a difficult time, you know, giving anybody a tough game, and they'd likely be in that play-in game.
Yeah, we talked about what I believe it was the Northeast Conference representative probably being the 16 in that play-in game. would think that there's a pretty good chance that they'll wind up playing the MEAC conference representative. And, you know, I mean, Norfolk State did have that run. What was it? 7 or 8 years ago now, really not a whole lot more to it than that for them. So, you know, this is a conference tournament though, that is played in Norfolk. So they, I believe it's still in Norfolk here this year. So Norfolk State will also be kind of a de facto home team in this conference tournament as well.
Yeah, I remember that being the case. As far as I know, it's still there again. And I remember this being one of the venues that's a pretty good under venue. So we'll talk about that more as we go forward. But this is a conference tournament where you would expect there would be some pretty bad shooting numbers because, you know, none of them can shoot very well to start with. And then you play in an arena that's known as an under venue. So that's something that I'd watch for from there. But, you know, as we look at this conference, it's just a very weak conference. I'm going to look down through here to see the teams as far as where I would rank them. Norfolk State, top, pretty easily top in my book. Bethune-Cookman next, pretty good defense, fifth most experienced team in the country. You have to give them some credit there. North Carolina Central, you know, I really like Moten, their coach. I think he's a very good coach. The thing that concerns me about them, they've played the weakest schedule in the country, and you hate that going into a tournament time. Howard has the best player in the conference, and Cole, they really take care of the basketball as well. I hope that we can get some decent odds on Howard, and they get a decent matchup in the conference tournament, because I would think that they could be a bit of a sleeper. North Carolina A&T next for me. Florida A&M, good defense for them, really bad offense. So bad that it's been very difficult for them to win some of their big games because they're just that bad on offense. Morgan State, another good coach, some talent here. Certainly think they have some potential. Savannah State, most people know Savannah State because of the way that they play and their tempo is just ridiculous. They run down as fast as they can, jack up a long jumper, and then play some really bad defense. I have noted that they've slowed down a decent amount here in the league, quite a bit slower than they were last year. So I don't know if that's a intentional move or if that's just kind of what they did, but they're certainly not playing at the crazy pace that they were earlier in the season, at least. South Carolina State would be next for me, then Coppin State, Delaware State, and Maryland Eastern Shore. And I will say those bottom two teams are about as bad as it gets in college basketball.
Yeah, and again, this is a very weak league, a one-and-done type of team here in the in March Madness, unless, of course, they get that 16 versus 16 play-in game, and maybe Norfolk State or somebody can pull off a victory there and then get crushed by one of the number one seeds. But still good to talk about this conference, and again, we will touch on it come conference tournament time, and also with that backdrop there at the Norfolk Scope Arena for the conference tournament. One quick note here. I know that we've had a couple of cutouts already here on this Skype recording. I apologize for that. Blog Talk Radio, again, doing its usual bullshit. So doing the best that we can here with this show. Hopefully it doesn't take away too much from the content here. So just bear with us as we go throughout this segment here. But in any event, Kyle, as we transition away from a conference that is absolutely terrible to a power conference that's not very good, you and I were talking about this before we started recording. I know you made a live play on Washington last night, a play that you would make again, but the Huskies failing to come through, the Pac-12 is probably a one-bid league at this point.
The Pac-12 should be a one-bid league. I'm curious to see if it actually happens because that's what they deserve. You know, is the conference or is the committee going to give this conference some of the, you know, extra love? Sometimes, you know, these big conferences that don't deserve as much as what they end up getting, you know, you kind of think because of their name or because they've been good in the past, they play favorites with them versus the mid-majors. I think that certainly has happened before. I really hope that a Pac-12 team doesn't get in instead of a mid-major that really deserves it. You know, that's one of the things that I would think first of all. And Washington, I mean, they get in the top 25 for the first time, and then they go and lose to Cal. And I was sitting there looking at Washington's resume here earlier this morning. Who has Washington beaten? I mean, Washington has not beaten anybody good. So you know, Washington, if they lose out pretty quickly, I mean, they'll likely get in the NCAA tournament, I guess, because, you know, who else are they going to put in? But if somebody else beats them in the Pac-12, Washington's got to be a bubble team, right? I mean, because, you know, if you look at their top games, they've lost all the best teams they've played.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so, and they should be. And the thing is, I hope that Washington wins the conference tournament just so that the Pac-12 only gets the one bid. If they don't, you know, then we'll see. And like you said, you know, and this is always such a challenging thing for the committee. I do wish that some mid-majors, some more mid-majors got in. Some teams that can make those storylines. I mean, who really wants to see, except unless you're a Washington fan, you know, who really wants to see a bad power conference team, you know, or a team from a bad power conference get in there over one of these mid-majors that at least has some life and could make things interesting? I mean, you know, look, March Madness is about the Cinderella stories until you get to the Elite Eight. Then it's about the best teams in the country. And I think the networks even would rather see a mid-major get in over a Washington or somebody like that. So we'll see how it plays out. But, yeah, I mean, for right now, the Pac-12 in both football and basketball really needs to fix something.
It's hard to believe they could be as bad as they are right now in football and basketball. I mean, because, you know, we started out the season, we knew how bad they were in football, and they're worse in basketball. And, yeah, I mean, that's hard to believe because, you know, at least in football they have a Washington team that is certainly a good team under Chris Peterson in college football. Basketball, I mean, Washington is the team that if they get into the tournament, they will be a tricky matchup because of that zone. I don't think people are going to want to play them, but Washington isn't going to be able to make a really deep run either because they're not consistent enough on offense to make a deep run. So, you know, I totally agree with you on the hope that the mid-majors make it in versus the power conference team, not just from the Pac-12, but in general, from the other conferences that are really not very deserving, because let's be honest, they have a shot every year. A lot of these mid-major teams don't really have a chance usually. So I hope that they get their chance this season.
All right. So as we transition away from the Pac-12 here, let's look at some fade and follow teams. And we start with the fade team here. This one, a major conference fade team. And I really like this one.
Yeah. Wisconsin, the Badgers. This is not so much that I think Wisconsin's a bad team, and I would say that this is more of a short-term look, but you can be laying decent-sized prices here against Penn State and Iowa. The Badgers off the double overtime loss to Indiana. Wisconsin's offense has not been very good here lately. I was looking at Bart Torvik's site. Six straight games for Wisconsin that they've been under their season average on three-point shooting percentage. So this is putting a lot of pressure on Happ to do it all on this offense. And I think Happ's a tremendous player. I know he's had a couple bad games here lately, and he's not very good at the free throw line, but even Happ is somebody that could help a lot of teams. You know, a lot of people would want to have him. That's for sure. I don't think Wisconsin's a very deep team. We're not making that three. You got like Trice, Davison, guys like that. If they're not making that 3-point shot, it puts a lot of pressure on this Wisconsin team to either have a bunch of, points from Ethan Happ on the inside or to win one of those 55-54 type games. And if the opponent's hitting some shots from outside, it can be difficult for them. And I think Wisconsin laying a big price is not something I'd be very interested in. So I think that they could be a good fade, especially based on the spot that they're in here coming up.
Now, as we look at the follow team, we've kind of been waiting for somebody to challenge VCU in the Atlantic 10. Dayton is a solid team, but you know, there's a pretty decent gap, I would say, between VCU and the rest of the conference here. Maybe this team is able to close that gap a little bit?
Yeah, maybe. I would say they're not as good as VCU or Dayton, but they're a team that's kind of come to be one of the competitors, at least, you know, some kind of competition for them. St. Bonaventure, I really like their way they're buying in on the defensive end. The Bonnies have held five straight opponents to 44.4% or lower on 2-point field goal attempts. Now that's really impressive. You know, I'm not talking 44.4% from the floor overall, 44.4% on 2-point field goal attempts. Very good. They have some really good shot blockers down low. If you start looking at their block shot stats, they're pretty impressive. So St. Bonnie's been buying in on the defensive end. If they were a little bit better on offense, they'd certainly be right up there with VCU, but their offense isn't quite efficient enough. You know, St. Bonnie's been playing good lately. So I wish I had said St. Bonnie a couple games ago because they've been on a nice streak here of late, but I think they can keep it going here for a while based on how strong their defense is.
All right, so let's get into some games for this weekend. And you notice we're kind of moving through this quickly because we want to talk some conference tournament stuff at the end of the segment here. And we'll also update you on what we plan to do with our schedule for recordings in the month of March. So let's go ahead and dive into the games here. And we'll start with a couple of heavyweights, and this is a game that a lot of people have been looking forward to, the rematch between Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yeah, huge game, and I think this game means more to Tennessee than Kentucky, and I'd be curious to get your take on that as well. I mean, Tennessee has more to prove. You know, Kentucky beat them the way that they did, you know, getting all those offensive rebounds. Kentucky, according to Bart Torvik, got 41.4% of their missed shots back in the first game. That's really the biggest key for Tennessee is can they keep Kentucky off the offensive glass? We've talked about Rick Barnes a lot before, and I don't think that he's done a bad job with this team thus far. Obviously, it's certainly been a good season for Tennessee. I do note that I think that Tennessee is not playing as well as they were earlier in the season. You know, they've had a couple losses, they've had a couple close games that you wonder if maybe they should have won a little bit easier than they have. I don't trust this Tennessee team in March, especially in the Big Dance. So, you know, Kentucky to me is a team with the much higher upside. I do think, though, that this is a game that means a lot to Tennessee. So I'd be hesitant to take Kentucky in this game. I'm curious to see where this line comes out. You know, I think it's going to be pretty close to pick 'em because Kentucky was favored there at home. Tennessee likely maybe minus one. I think that this game, like I said, means more to Tennessee. Tennessee has more to prove, in my opinion. Would you agree with that, Adam?
Yeah, I would. I especially when you lose by 17 in the first meeting. You know, I mean, that was a game that was billed as such a top five type of showdown. And, you know, now, I mean, you've got your chance at retribution. You've got your chance at retribution at home. And also, too, you know, I mean, is this a number one seed elimination game in the NCAA tournament? That's something that I'm kind of interested in here, too. I mean, obviously, you know, the conference tournament could sort of define that. But I do wonder here, you know, if you're Tennessee and you lose this game, do you have any chance at being a number one seed? I don't think so. I don't know if they do to begin with, but you know, obviously you would like to be able to hang that banner, so to speak. I guess game means a lot to Tennessee, especially being the newer kid on the block. Kentucky's been there, done that. Tennessee, I think this is a game that would really help them in terms of their confidence going into, you know, the month of madness here.
Yeah, and that's what would make me pause if I was looking to bet Kentucky here. It's just that Tennessee has so much on the line. Kentucky has already shown that they can beat these top-notch teams. They already had that blowout of Tennessee. They've had some impressive wins here. They beat Kansas at home, went to Auburn and won, beat North Carolina on neutral. This is a Kentucky team that I think we know what they are. You know, Kentucky's a really good defense. A lot of block shots, a lot of length on defense, really good on the offensive boards. What's Tennessee, though? I mean, Tennessee is a good team. There's nobody doubting that. Tennessee is a experienced team. I mean, they're fifth in minutes continuity in the country. So they have a lot of, you know, they're a very experienced team, not necessarily a really deep team. They do pass it well. Assists per field goals made seventh in the country. So Tennessee moves the ball pretty well here. They're better on offense than they are on defense. But, you know, if you look at some of their games throughout the course of the season, they've won a lot of close games. And some of those close games have been against opponents they shouldn't have had close games against. So they had a 3-point win at home against Alabama, an overtime win on the road against Vanderbilt. Games like that would make you be concerned about Tennessee. And like I said, I don't really like the trajectory that they're on at this point. I think that, you know, Kentucky is getting better and better from the beginning of the season to now. I don't see the same thing about Tennessee.
Yeah, I really don't either. And, you know, this is the time of year when you really want to be rounding into form. And that's why a team like Michigan State is so dangerous year in and year out, because Tom Izzo always has this team ready to go when we get to the month of March. And that's something, you know, we talk about Rick Barnes, and we've kicked a lot of dirt on the guy before. And, you know, maybe in some instances he's deserved it, and maybe in others he hasn't. But this is the time when you define your legacy and what you are as a head coach. So if Tennessee comes out and plays really well here and then follows it up with Mississippi State and Auburn, that's a really good sign going forward. If Tennessee can't capitalize on this opportunity and has issues down the line in the conference tournament or the last two regular season games, Tennessee will be a team I will not take for a deep run in March.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as far as March, whether they're going to make a deep run, I'd be hesitant to back them regardless, because Rick Barnes has not proven that he can win. Then, like you said, if they play really well in this game and then show very well in the conference tournament, then maybe you at least consider it. But also at that point, if they play that well, then their price is going to be pretty expensive. So to me, you know, this year and the way that they play in the big dance is going to say a lot about Rick Barnes going forward.
All right, so we move on to the Ohio Valley Conference here, but we stay in that part of the country as we look at Austin Peay and Murray State. And this was a game that I isolated on Wednesday in my Wednesday weekend look-ahead video over on our Bang the Book YouTube page. It's taken on a little bit of a different appearance now because of what happened to Austin Peay last night.
Yeah, Austin Peay getting upset by Eastern Kentucky 82-80 was certainly something that changed the look of this game quite a bit. Because, you know, if you look at the conference standings in the OVC, you got Belmont and Murray State tied at the top. Now you've got Austin Peay is too far back to where, you know, they don't have a chance at it. They're 13-4. It looked like they might only have 3 losses going into this game. Now they have the 4 losses. What does that mean for this game? I mean, I'd be very hesitant to back Austin Peay now. Murray State has a lot to play for here. They're a very good team. I know Murray State beat Morehead State 71-52 on Thursday night. I believe that game was like 52-19 at one point. So they definitely let off the gas in that game. Murray State's been playing very well here of late. Austin Peay, a very good season this year, better than most people thought they would be. They don't have the talent that Murray State does. And they're coming off that disappointing loss. And you have to wonder, what does this game mean now to Austin Peay? I mean, do they want to play spoiler or not? Because that's basically what they have to play for in this game. Murray has a lot to play for here with the OVC title. Austin Peay, you could easily see them saying, well, you know, let's make our conference tournament run. So if we got one regular season game left, and here it is. You know, Austin Peay slowed down the first game quite a bit. The tempo was very slow in that game. I want to see if they'll do the same thing here. And I would guess the tempo will be faster in this game than what it was in the first game. Murray's trying to push the pace with their athletes. Murray's going to be laying a pretty big number here. So do I really want to lay 10.5 points or whatever it might be here? Not anxious to do that, but I'd certainly be cautious about Austin Peay based on the spot.
Austin Peay in the first game lost by a bucket at home, 73-71, which is very high scoring for a game with 62 possessions. So yeah, be interesting to see what the total looks like for this game. If the expectation is that, you know, Murray State's able to dictate the tempo a little bit more, play this game closer to 69 or 70 possessions, which is where Austin Peay has averaged for the season. So that'll be a really interesting thing to look at here in this one. Fun game that doesn't have as much importance now as it previously did, but maybe a game to consider as we head into the Ohio Valley Conference Tournament here next week. Let's go out to the Mountain West. Nevada takes on Utah State. This is a really intriguing game here coming up on Saturday because you've got a Nevada team that, you know, hasn't been tested a ton in conference play. You would think they should get a really good test here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is going to be a great game. And as I was making my notes here for this, this is the game where I just kept making more notes and looking at it even more. I really like this game. You know, this is the game I'm looking forward to the most on Saturday. Utah State has been really well coached this year by Craig Smith. Great job by him. Look at what they were last year. They were 17-17, 23-6 so far this year. They were 230th in effective field goal percentage defense last year, 20th this year. And they've also proved that they can do it multiple ways. Utah State in the non-conference was really pushing the pace, playing very quickly, have slowed down a lot here in conference action, playing almost 7 possessions slower per game in conference than non-conference. Now, it's normal to slow down, and you'll see a lot of teams, you know, 2.5 possessions slower than what they were. 7 possessions is a very big change, much bigger than normal. So Utah State slowed down a lot. They're winning with really good defense. They're 2nd in the nation in defensive rebounding percentage. And we've talked about many times in the past how much that's really important. I think most people underrate getting those defensive rebounds. Giving a team second chance is really a big killer. And you also look at this Utah State team, 5th in the country in assists per field goals made. I think all these things are signs of a great coach. You know, you look at not giving a team second chance points, passing the ball around, playing very good defense. And in your first year, if you're able to turn the team around that much, it really speaks highly of the coach. Look, Nevada has more talent in this game. So if you're going just based on talent alone, Nevada would have to get the edge here. I think as far as how this game will play out, I think Utah State's going to try to pack it in and make Nevada beat them with a three. Nevada's definitely going to want to get out in transition and try to score before Utah State sets up their defense. But Utah State ranks in the 96th percentile in transition defense, according to Synergy Sports. So Utah State's been really good at stopping teams from getting out in transition. Also, one thing that I think we should definitely note, Utah State, a great home court advantage. Nevada's had a couple slip-ups here in the conference. They should be ready for this game, though, because, you know, it's no surprise to them. This game means a lot to both teams if you look at the standings. So should be a great game here.
Yeah, it definitely should be. And these two teams played January 2nd, which feels like an eternity ago. Nevada won 72-49, 0.651 points per possession for Utah State in that game.
Ouch.
0.651. Every game since then, they've had over a point per possession and have had several games where they've had at least 1.2 points per possession. So almost feels like that game was a turning point for them. You know, because since then, and they've been really, really good. Had the 1 point loss at Fresno, lost at San Diego State, but played pretty well overall in both of those games. So this is a much different Utah State team. And what's going to be really interesting here, also the line for this game, you lost by 23 in the first game. And this game is going to be what? Maybe Utah State plus two, plus 1.5, something like that. That's a really interesting thing that should catch a lot of people's attention on Saturday.
Yeah, I think Utah State +1, +1.5 in that range. And I'm very interested to see what the total is as well, because if you look at the first game, like you said, it was very fast paced and Utah State just couldn't make a shot. I think Utah State wants to slow this game more than they did the first game. It didn't work to play at Nevada's pace the first time around, 75 possessions in that game. I think this one, they want it to be under 70. So let's see what the total comes out at. Would probably lean to the under here, I think, based on the intensity from two teams. And I will just note that in general, when you get to the end of the regular season, you want to look for games where there's two good teams playing against each other, and that game means a lot to them. If you like the under, that's a good spot for it in the long term.
There's something to maybe consider. I mean, if Utah State wins this game, right, their losses on the year, Arizona State on a neutral, nothing wrong with that. BYU on the road, tough place to play. Houston, obviously a very, very good team. Nevada, Fresno State by a point at home. Lost to San Diego State on the road, but San Diego State, of course, you know, had that nice performance earlier on in the year against Nevada. Does Utah State put themselves in the at-large consideration bubble if they win this game?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Utah State would probably be in the discussion even if they lose this game, if it's a tight game. But as weak as the bubble is this year, Utah State wins this game, unless something really falls apart, I think they're going to be in the tournament. In fact, if you just look at Utah State's resume and compare it to Washington, you know, does Washington have a better resume than Utah State? I mean, I wouldn't say so. So, you know, Utah State's a team that has really been under the radar this year, but they've played very well. The Mountain West is not much worse than the Pac-12. You know, the bottom of the Mountain West is pretty bad with Wyoming and San Jose State, but there are some decent teams here. You know, Fresno State's been pretty good this year. San Diego State's turned it around here of late. I think the Mountain West Conference has been a little bit better than I thought it would be at the beginning of the season based on some of these teams outperforming.
All right, so we got a really good slate of games here on Saturday. I mean, just in general, very, very solid list of games. You've got the Kentucky-Tennessee game. You've got Iowa State and Texas should be a good one. The one we just talked about between Nevada and Utah State. Texas Tech and TCU is a really interesting game for, you know, seeding and bubble purposes. Gonzaga and St. Mary's, always a war. You've also got a good game in the AAC, potentially, between UCF and Houston.
I think this is a really good game. UCF, a team that I thought was kind of disappointing for a while this year, have certainly played a lot better here of late. They went to Cincinnati and lost by 5. They could have won that game. That was a very tightly contested game. I think UCF had a real chance in that game. I watched a lot of that game. In fact, I thought UCF looked like the better team for a lot of that game, but had a rough stretch there, even some questionable calls there at the end of the game, and then lost by 5. But if you look at their performances of late, you know, they have some pretty nice wins at SMU. SMU is not a tremendous team right now, but that's still a pretty good win on the road. They won at UConn a while back, and then they go to South Florida, a team that's been quite a bit better here this season, and won by 12. You know, UCF is a team that is definitely on the bubble right now. They're playing quite a bit better of late, but they don't have those big wins. You know, they need a big win. This is a really good chance for them to get that big win. Houston's been tremendous. You know, UCF, a team that if you look at their, you know, kind of the fingerprint of what their team looked like last year compared to this year, UCF's playing a lot faster this year. It surprises me that they've sped up this much. They were using 19 and a half seconds per possession offensively last year in conference play, only 17 and a half so far this season. So they've definitely tried to pick up the pace. Houston has also played a little bit faster here in recent games, and they've not been afraid to run up the score in some of their games here late either. The first game was 77 to 68 with a tempo of 70 possessions. So they got up and down pretty good in that game. I'm looking at the over here as a possibility if we get a low 130s number. I think that both teams here a little bit better at scoring than people would have thought. And Houston's defense, obviously tremendous. UCF gives up a lot of second chance points, and I think Houston can get second chance points here. Both teams get to the line a decent amount, UCF more so. To me, this is one of those games that could really define UCF's season. You know, this, they have a lot riding on this game. I think UCF's right on the bubble right now. Obviously, Houston's going to get a good seed, and they've had a great season. This game means more to UCF than it does to Houston. But if you just go and look at the American Athletic Conference, Houston's only one game up on Cincinnati, so they still need to win this game also. What kind of number is Houston going to be laying here? You know, Houston is going to be favored likely by 7.5 or 8 points in my mind. And I would say that, you know, my lean here would be UCF and the over.
One more game to touch on here as we head on down to the SoCon, Wofford and Samford. Interesting game here as well. And again, such a strong weekend card in college basketball. What are you looking at here in this one?
Well, if you look at the first time these two played, Wofford needed a buzzer beater in overtime at home to beat Samford. Samford is a much more talented team than if you look at their record, I think they've disappointed based on, you know, the kind of wins that they have this year. They look like a team that's ready to go toward the very top of their conference, but they're too inconsistent. This is a young team. I think Samford will be better here in the next year or two than what they are right now. But I think they put a lot of effort in this game because they remember the way they lost that first one. At the same time, Wofford has a bunch to play for as well. An unbeaten season in the league, potential at-large berth. And I will say, I really think Wofford should be in the tournament. They better get in. So I think regardless of what they do here at the end, hopefully they don't have some terrible loss at the beginning of their conference tournament or something. But Wofford's been so good this year, it'd be hard to not put them in. How much is Wofford going to be laying here? Because Samford hasn't played very well lately. Wofford's been obviously in great form. Maybe 7.5 points here for Wofford. I would lean toward taking the underdog. I will say that this is a game that feels like it could be, you know, quite a bit of variance involved in this one, because it wouldn't stun me if Wofford wins by 20 points. It also wouldn't stun me if this game goes down to the final shot. I think this is a very interesting game because as long as Samford is highly motivated based on that first game, wanting to try to get some revenge and put in a strong effort here, I think there's potential of this going right down to the buzzer. At the same time, Samford has been slumping a bit of late and has had some tough losses. It wouldn't be shocking if they aren't as up for this game as Wofford. So to me, this is one of those fascinating handicaps that I really like to talk about.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one too, especially because, as you mentioned, Samford, a very young team here. And, you know, this is one of those spots where you kind of look at those senior day considerations and say, well, there aren't many. You know, they've got a big 7-foot senior in Ruben Guerrero. They've got a 6'7" senior in Stefan Lakic, who doesn't play very much. So maybe he winds up slotting into the starting lineup. But this isn't a situation where, you know, you've got a team that's going to run 4 seniors out there or 5 seniors with 3 or 4 guys that aren't very good, that don't play a whole lot. Samford's probably going to run out what looks like their usual starting lineup. So that's a benefit to where they don't have to play catch up. And some teams in these games this weekend may have to play catch up at the first, you know, at the under 16 or the under 12 TV timeout. So that's a consideration in a lot of games this weekend, not this one, and Samford with a young, up-and-coming type of team, I agree with you that they're going to put a lot of effort into this one.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, why would they not try hard in this one? I will say that they've had three overtime games in their last five games and not a very deep team, so that's certainly a negative for them. Wofford is the deeper team. They're the better team. Look, nobody's denying that. Wofford's played a tougher schedule. They're an experienced team. Wofford's doing everything right here at the end of the season. I have nothing negative to say about them. I think this is just more about the handicap here is what do you think Samford's going to do in this game? Because I think we know what Wofford is. And Wofford has proven that they can win on the road, that they can dominate teams even that are pretty good teams. So what happens in a game like this? I don't know. I think that this is going to be very telling about Samford as well. I think Samford's a team that could be a sleeper in the SoCon tournament if they turn it around and play well in this game. Because I think if they get some momentum, some positive feelings about how things are going for them instead of just slumping into the end of the season, I think Samford does have the talent to make some noise.
All right, so we're going to talk about the Atlantic Sun Conference tournament here to wrap up this segment of Handicapping the Hardwood, because we're not sure if we're going to go on Monday or Tuesday with our first segment. I can tell you our second segment will be on Wednesday, but we're not sure what sort of conference tournament odds we're going to have early on in the week here. I also may need to move some of my guests around as well. So we don't know if we're going to go Tuesday, Wednesday, or Monday, Wednesday next week. We'll do Wednesdays as we go throughout the rest of March here, obviously with so many games on Thursday and Friday. So definitely Handicapping the Hardwood every Wednesday in March. We'll let you know if next week is going to be Monday or Tuesday. I'll figure that out over the weekend here. But the Atlantic Sun Conference Tournament starts on Monday. So because we're not sure if we're going to do Monday or Tuesday, we wanted to make sure we touched on it here on today's show. Look, really, when you talk about the A-Sun Tournament, which is played at the campus site of the higher-seeded team, this basically comes down to Lipscomb and Liberty, and who has home court advantage in the likely championship game.
Right. Yeah, I'm sitting here trying to look at this conference and see somebody that might threaten them, you know, who would be a team to watch. It's hard to come up with one. You know, I mean, these two teams are a lot better than everybody else. There's a huge gap there. I would say probably NJIT would be the next team that I would say has a little bit of a chance to cause some trouble in this tournament, partially because they play so well in defense. They have a really good freshman in Zach Cooks. NJIT is a team that I think is a bit of a sleeper, but at the same time, you look at Lipscomb and Liberty, they're both veteran teams. They're both very good, both on offense and defense. You know, you look at the best offenses in this conference and look at the best defenses. Lipscomb's just barely the best offense in the conference. Lipscomb's the best defense in the conference as well. Who's number two in both of those? Liberty. You know, to me, it's really hard to see somebody else winning this one. The question is, you know, how much of a favorite would Lipscomb be against Liberty? I think Lipscomb has not played quite as well here of late as they did earlier in the season. We had them lose that game at home to Liberty. They also lost on the road to Florida Gulf Coast and then had a close game here at home against NJIT, the team I was just talking about. So Lipscomb not really playing in their best form right now. Earlier in the season, I would have thought they'd be a pretty significant favorite here. Now I think they'd be a small favorite. You know, to me, Liberty's a team that controls the tempo very well. I like that Liberty's able to slow the game down, good at taking care of the basketball, also can force a lot of turnovers on the defensive end. You know, if you look at Lipscomb, they play really fast, so you get some pace wars when Lipscomb and Liberty play. You know, this is an interesting conference because the top two teams are quality teams. You know, to me, if Lipscomb or Liberty gets in the tournament in the big dance, they could give somebody a hard time. You know, this is a spot where while I like underdog runs in conference tournaments, I do hope Lipscomb or Liberty wins this conference tournament because I think that they could be a lot of fun to watch in the big dance.
Well, and as we look at what odds could be like for this conference tournament, the A-Sun finishes up regular season play tonight. So we don't know who's going to have home court advantage between Lipscomb and Liberty as of yet. You would think both teams do take care of business here tonight. I believe Lipscomb has the tiebreaker, even though they split in the regular season. So if Lipscomb is at home, You look at the line for Lipscomb at home on February 13th. They were a 7.5-point favorite against Liberty. Liberty was a 2.5-point favorite at home against Lipscomb and lost that game by 20. So my guess here would be Lipscomb in the plus 115-ish range if they're the number one seed. Maybe in the plus 125, 130 range if they're the number two seed. Liberty probably what? Plus 140, plus 150, something like that. And then everybody else, at least 7 or 8 to 1 or higher, maybe even 9 or 1 to higher, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good guess. I think, 120 and then 145 or something like that. And then probably, 850 or 9 to 1. And like I said, it's hard. I don't think I could make a bet on anybody else other than those two teams. NJIT would be the only one I'd really consider. North Florida's had some success in the past. Florida Gulf Coast has been good in the past, but they aren't this year. And there's a lot of weak teams at the bottom of this league that really won't give anybody a hard time. So I feel like the top seeds could have a pretty easy path here. We'll see what happens, but it'd be a pretty big surprise to see somebody other than Lipscomb or Liberty. And, you would think that that will be the final game here in the A-Sun. If so, I think it's going to be very high quality game. And like I said, two teams that could give somebody a hard time.
Well, and again, as you look at these two head-to-head meetings, Liberty losing by 20 at home as a small favorite, then winning on the road by 8 as a 7.5-point dog. I'm guessing if Lipscomb is the home team here for the championship game, the line meets somewhere in the middle. Maybe Lipscomb minus 4.5, 4.5, something like that. If you're looking at Liberty at plus 150 or plus 145, there's no point in making that bet because you'll get a number similar or better in the head-to-head game to decide the winner of the Atlantic Sun tournament. So really, to me, I think the only position you can take at the start of this tournament is probably Lipscomb at plus money when they'll be a favorite in all three games.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to take Liberty when, I think 4.5 is a good guess as to what they would be on the road against Lipscomb. That game that Lipscomb lost at home, they were 3 for 18 from 3-point range. So that was really the difference in that game. If you look at the first game that the two of these teams played, it's interesting in that Liberty got their pace, but Lipscomb dominated that game. Liberty went 4 of 22 shooting the 3-pointer. So, I mean, that was the difference in those games is, who knocks down the 3-point shot. That's something that's fairly difficult to predict. I think these two teams are fairly similar as far as how good they are. Lipscomb has the better body of work so far this year, but Lipscomb has not really, finished the season quite as strong as they started it. So not sure how to look on that one because I think that last game would be very tight. I'd be more inclined to take the points with Liberty based on what I've seen here of late.
Well, and again, so when you look at these leagues that are kind of two horse races, you want to try to project out some lines, project out what you think that conference tournament final game would look like. As I said, you could probably get the same or better price on Liberty in that one-off game and avoid something crazy happening in the first two games. With Lipscomb, they're going to be a favorite, going to be minus on the money line. So them plus money at the start is a good starting position for you. Then if you want, you play back on Liberty, you play plus the points, you free roll the championship game here in the A-Sun. So we'll talk more about these specific betting strategies and situations as we have odds for these conference tournaments. But just to give you some general tips here to start thinking about what you want to look for here, you want to keep in mind teams that run into the top seed in the semifinals, you have to get a really good price on them. Where you expect the conference tournament final to be, you want to be able to get a better price on the underdog for the futures line than for that individual game line. And then obviously, too, you want to try to project these lines out as we go forward.
Yeah, and it's a lot different when you look at one conference to another based on, whether there's a big drop down from the top team or the top couple teams. And, in a conference tournament like this, you can just look at those two teams and see what the line would be against each other. It gets a lot more complicated if you're looking at a league where you don't even really know who the favorite is. So, we'll certainly have some leagues like that as we talk about the conference tournaments to where, we don't have one team or two teams that's really dominated the tournament and it's wide open. Then it can be a little bit harder to project something like this, but we'll do the best we can breaking those conferences down. And certainly I always look forward to this time of the year.
Yeah, I do too. And for our listeners out there, I will do the Monday mailbag on Monday. So send me your listener questions at Skating Tripods on Twitter or adam@bangthebook.com. If you've got additional conference tournament questions, and we will talk about the ones I got last week about money line rollovers, about shooting backdrops, good conference tournaments for the over, good conference tournaments for the under. Those two questions are already in reserve for whenever Kyle and I talk, whether it's Monday or Tuesday. So we'll talk about those, but send over your additional conference tournament questions for the Monday mailbag. Even if I don't use them on that segment, I'll use them here with Kyle, whether we do that on Monday or Tuesday. So Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. What's going on over at the website right now, man?
Putting out the March Madness package here today. Get an early start with that. I'll lower the price for that based on what how much of this season has been played thus far. So check that out at huntersportspicks.com. Also, if you haven't already signed up for that free picks newsletter over there, no cost to sign up. You'll get some free picks sent your way. I'll also be doing a March Madness bracket tournament there for some cash prizes there for newsletter subscribers. So if you haven't signed up for that already, I encourage you to do so.
Well, and again, so not sure if on Monday we'll have Kyle. We'll talk about it. We'll figure it out. We'll see how many conference tournament sets of odds we think we're actually going to have. If it's not enough to do a strong segment, we'll just push him back to Tuesday. I'll either move Brian Blessing or Ralph Michaels to Monday. So that'll be the plan for Monday, Tuesday, and then we'll definitely have Kyle on Wednesday to break down conference tournaments. So Kyle Hunter, huntersportspicks.com, video coming up today at our Bang the Book YouTube page for tomorrow's card. Also the Daily College Basketball Picks piece. Thank you so much for the time, man. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again either Monday or Tuesday.
All right, thanks. We'll talk to you then.
There you go. There's Kyle Hunter again, huntersportspicks.com, and also daily contributor to bangthebook.com. Coming up on our Monday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we will have the Monday mailbag, and then either Kyle or one of our Tuesday guests. So just keep it tuned. I'll let you know what we've got going on. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening throughout the week, everybody. Have a happy, healthy, smart, safe weekend. And I will talk to you again on Monday.